On the evening of September 26, 2024, in MSU Bozeman's Gaines Hall Auditorium, the four candidates running to fill the Associate Justice and Chief Justice seats on the Montana Supreme Court in this November 5, 2024 election debated issues and answered questions posed by moderator Missy O'Malley. It was hosted by the Gallatin Bar Association and the Montana State Pre-Law Club. KGVM was there to record the event, which was in two parts with a brief intermission. First was a debate between the candidates for the Associate Justice position between Montana 7th Judicial District Court Judge Catherine Bidigari and Montana 11th Judicial District Court Judge Dan Wilson. This was followed by the debate for the Chief Justice seat between retired Federal Magistrate Judge, United States District Court for the District of Montana, Jerry Lynch, and Broadwater County Attorney Corey Swanson. We also offer this recording of the debate in two parts. Here now are the candidates for the Associate Justice position, Montana 7th Judicial Court Judge Catherine Bidigari and Montana 11th Judicial District Court Judge Dan Wilson.
Started. My name is Andrea Collins. I am the president of the Gallatin County Bar Association. Thank you so much for attending the Montana Supreme Court Candidate Forum. We do have all four perspective candidates here in attendance, and Missy O'Malley is going to moderate today's event. So without further ado, she has a few opening remarks, and then the candidates will take it away.
Thank you so much, Andrea. Thank you all so much for being here. Like she said, what a beautiful night here on Montana State campus, and it's just a treat to have all of you here. And I know that we have some students signing up to get their extra credit. So, of course, that is incredibly important. We appreciate that. So there'll be a little bit of movement in the back of the room as we get started. And we do have some local media. We do have a documentary that's being filmed tonight. If you do not wish to be on camera, please feel free to reach out to these media members, the camera women and men, and please feel free to let them know that you don't want your face on the news or this documentary. With that being said, I'm going to give you a quick run of show and how we're going to do things tonight. As you can see, I do have two of our associate justice candidates standing behind me, and I'm going to explain how the evening's going to go. I do just want to say a quick thank you to the Gallatin Bar Association and the MSU pre-law students that also helped to make this happen. Can we have a big, quick round of applause? It took a lot of work to make this happen. We have a lot of them in the room. As Andrea mentioned, my name is Missy O'Malley. I will be your moderator for tonight. The candidates for the Associate Justice position are going to be going first. We've allotted about 1 hour to get through the questions. We unfortunately do not have time to take questions from the crowd this evening, but we have a plethora of questions, and I promise you that we're going to do our best to get through as much as possible. And the way that works then, of course, for the chief, we're going to take a five-minute intermission after our Associate Justice candidates do their remarks here. We'll take a five-minute intermission, and then we'll finish with the final hour with the Chief Justice candidate positions. We do have a list of questions that have been provided to all four candidates prior to tonight's event. They've had a chance to look things over. The way that things are going to work, we did a little bit of a coin toss, theoretically. Judge Bidigari will be going first, so she will answer the first question. She has 60 seconds for her response. Then Judge Dan Wilson, to my right, will have a 90-second response time. Then it goes back to Judge Bidigari for a 30-second final remark. So 60, 90, 60. And then every other question, we flip-flop. So then Judge Wilson will be answering first for the second question. We're all with me on this? It's a numbers game, folks. And thank goodness I have Andrea Collins here as my timekeeper. She will be signaling to the candidates if they've run out of time for their remarks. On top of that, we don't have him quite on Zoom yet, but Judge Jerry Lynch will be joining us via Zoom as well. And in person, the county attorney, Corey Swanson from Broadwater County, will be joining us in person for the Chief Justice Supreme Court candidate forum that's happening second. And just really quick before we do get started, I want to say a big thank you to Bjorn Boyer over here, Ralph Steele, Sarah Callow, Sarah Crawford, Andrea Collins, and Brianne Wilson, who actually couldn't be with us tonight, but they were part of our main committee along with the MSU pre-law students. So just one big thank you, round of applause before we get started in just a moment here. Thank you. All right, folks, we are going to begin. And I just want to make sure that Judge Jerry Lynch can hear us. I think he's on mute. I just want to make sure that he has it. And the time is 6:34. So we have 1 hour to get through as many questions as we possibly can. Again, ladies first, Judge Bitigary, to my right here, the current judge, excuse me, let me just get this correct, for the 7th Judicial District covering Dawson, Macon, Prairie, Richland, and Weibo counties. Thank you for being here with us tonight. Judge Dan Wilson, currently the judge for the 11th Judicial District covering Flathead County. Thank you for being here tonight. Okay, folks, we're going to get started. We have a few different categories of questions. We're going to start off with qualifications and experience. Judge Bitigary, we'll start with you. Describe one or more notable experiences in the law which you believe prepared you for a role on the Supreme Court.
Thank you. I cannot identify just one or more experiences that qualify this position. I've been an attorney for almost 39 years. In a couple of weeks, it'll be 39 years. And for the first 18 of those years, I practiced law. First four were in state government, where my function was to protect Montana consumers against insurance and securities fraud. The next 14 years were in the general practice of law, which exposed me to many different kinds of law in rural Montana, including agricultural law, business law, oil and gas law, family law, criminal law, and estate and probate planning. So I had the opportunity to deal with so many different kinds of cases, all of which really serve as a foundational basis for when I became a district court judge. I was elected in 2002 for the first time and have been elected four times more.
Thank you. Again, the question for you, Judge Wilson, describe one or more notable experiences in the law which you believe prepared you for a role in the Supreme Court.
Thank you. The last 30 or so years of mine have been a series of steps, a journey, and one of the most notable cases that I worked on was one that hit the press about 13 years ago but didn't get much attention because I didn't try to publicize it. A criminal defendant had been convicted in federal court of taking part in numerous armed robberies, and she wasn't the gun person. She was the person who drove the getaway car. But she had a number of intellectual and developmental deficits and went to trial instead of taking a plea bargain because she did not understand how a person who wasn't the gunman could be charged and convicted with the offense. Well, her co-defendant got 17 years because he testified against her, and she got 159. And this case received a lot of attention nationwide as one of the reasons we should not have mandatory sentences. I accepted an appointment to represent her. The long and short of it was that I was able to find that her attorneys actually had committed an error. I pointed it out to the federal judge, who then encouraged the U.S. attorney to settle the case. The problem that I had is that my client could not understand how she could be guilty, and so winning a new trial wasn't going to do the trick. The U.S. attorney and I, however, worked out an arrangement. We worked out a deal where she had her sentence reduced from 159 to 7 years and ultimately served what was probably a just sentence. And that was an experience that taught me just how every legal case not only has important legal principles, but it's really about the people.
Thank you. Do you have a 30-second response?
I do. So in 21 years as a district court judge, I have had the opportunity to see firsthand the difference that it makes to have fairness and impartiality in our courts. I've been committed to that. I have a reputation for that, and that's something that I would bring to the Montana Supreme Court. The general jurisdiction covers more than just criminal cases, and so I've had the opportunity to do that for quite a lengthy period of time. That gives me the experience that I think is really imperative at this time in our history for people on Montana's highest court.
Thank you. Okay, moving to our next question, Judge Wilson, you'll be answering first. How would you approach a case where the law is unclear or conflicting?
That is such a great question, and it's really broad. If you ask the attorneys in any case who are concerned about the law being applied in an unfortunate way against their client, they are very prone to say it's clear and unclear and conflicting. But the role of a judge is to look at the law with objective eyes to view the law in the light of prior cases decided, particularly by our Montana Supreme Court, and merely apply it in an objective way. And in so ruling, make the law clearer than it was perhaps when the judge encountered and found it. I don't know that there's any other approach that a judge can take that will benefit both to the parties and to the future of the law than to provide that clarity and stability.
Judge Bidegiri, I'll ask it for you one more time. How would you approach the case, a case where the law is unclear or conflicting?
Well, the role of the judiciary is to interpret and apply laws. So oftentimes you have attorneys presenting both sides of the issue, which make it look like there's a conflict. My role as a judge would be to base my decisions based on the relevant facts, the applicable law, paying attention to the constitutional restraints that are placed upon us by the Montana Constitution and the United States Constitution. Those decisions do need to be based on established legal precedents because that's what gives stability to our economy, to our whole judicial system, and also promotes resolution of disputes. When there is a conflict and it's not clear, and the cases that have been presented to me don't seem to address the issue clearly, I conduct my own legal research to see if maybe there are other cases that I can find that are more on point, which means that they match more clearly with the facts that are at issue before me. If I find cases that are more applicable, then I will rely on those. But almost every case, every one of which is important because it's critically important to the litigants who are involved, involves some sort of lack of clarity or conflict, and that's the reason why the case has been brought before the courts, because it wasn't something that could have been resolved by the litigants themselves or the attorneys representing them.
Do you have a response?
Thank you. Yeah. When there is a clear conflict in the law and the judge is called upon to resolve it, the judge should first look to the most weighty authority, and typically that is a constitutional provision. If it's been discussed, if it's been reviewed and decided previously by the Supreme Court, then that is the more weighty concern than perhaps the opinion of the lawyers or even of another district court. So in resolving a conflict, I go first to the most weighty authority and the most reliable one.
Thank you. Up next, Judge Bidegiri, for you, the question is, please discuss or describe your experience working in diverse legal environments or on cases involving varied cultural perspectives. How have those experiences served to shape your judicial philosophy?
Thank you. Having been an attorney for almost 39 years and having been a district court judge for more than half of that time, 21 years, I've had the opportunity to address cases in all parts of Montana. As a district court judge, I have handled and presided over cases in 40 of the 56 counties in Montana. And you know that I've noticed that culture can differ even from county to county. But one thing that this experience has taught me is that regardless of where the issue is, the law is the law. The rule of law abides. No one is above or below the law. And it's important that to every litigant, no matter where they are, no matter what culture is involved, that the judge be neutral, apply the law as has been established, consider only the relevant facts, and consider only what's on the record and not outside influences. And that is what I have learned to be the true expectation of every litigant that appears before me.
Thank you, Judge Wilson. Once again, the question is, please discuss or describe your experience working in diverse legal environments or on cases involving varied cultural perspectives, and how have those experiences served to shape your judiciary philosophy?
About two decades ago, I accepted an appointment to represent a member of the Blackfeet tribe who had been charged with unlawfully killing an animal just over the boundary in Glacier Park. The cultural background of that experience was that the Blackfeet had negotiated a treaty with the United States in 1895 that allowed them to take game from that part of what is now Glacier Park in perpetuity. And the issue in that case had everything to do with the historical context of how the Blackfeet would have understood the language of that treaty at the time it was negotiated. It was fascinating. But the most important aspect to me in working in that different cultural environment was coming to understand just how vital and important those continuing treaty rights are within that culture, and not resting until I fully understood my client's perspective. And it took a lot of hours to get that history and that context in place. Ultimately, the federal judge in Missoula decided that that treaty right had been taken away or abrogated by Congress, and we were about to argue it in the Ninth Circuit in Seattle when the tribe prevailed upon my client to withdraw his appeal. But that was one of the most formative experiences for me, and highlighted the importance that, again, it's not just about the law, it's about the people.
Thank you. And your response?
So confining it to, excuse me, my experience in diverse places, I have, you know, practiced law as a government attorney. I've practiced law as a private attorney, and then I've been a district court judge. People of all different kinds of cultures have appeared before me from all different kinds of countries. But basically, we are required to do an equal application of the law to every person, regardless of their culture. When culture is relevant to an issue before me and information of it is presented into the record, I consider that and give it the weight it deserves.
Thank you. Our next section of questions are judicial philosophy and decision-making. And Judge Wilson, we start with you on this. Appellate court justices, in particular, often have divergent views on the methodology of constitutional decision-making. Please explain to us, in general, your fundamental belief in regard to the interpretation and application of the decisions involving the Montana State Constitution as well as the U.S. Constitution.
Well, there aren't that many novel questions under the U.S. Constitution after several hundred years of our Supreme Court sort of weighing in and explaining those various provisions. And as Associate Justice of the Montana Supreme Court, I would not have the same sort of authority to weigh in on the meaning of the U.S. Constitution over and above what the U.S. Supreme Court might say. The Montana Constitution is quite different. It's relatively young, and we have a tremendous written record that's available for how the delegates for the Constitutional Convention debated, understood, explained, argued about the various provisions. So there is a wealth of information. My philosophy for interpreting the Montana Constitution is that we look to its original intent. And if it's not plain from the words itself, then we go back foremost to the history of the delegation that debated it.
Thank you. So the question for you again. Appellate court justices, in particular, often have divergent views on the methodology of constitutional decision-making. Now, please to explain to us in general your fundamental belief in regard to interpretation and application of decisions involving the Montana Constitution as well as the U.S. Constitution.
The United States Constitution provides citizens basic rights. Each state is entitled to give its, through its own constitution, give its citizens additional rights. Montana Constitution gives us rights that the United States Constitution does not include. When there is a conflict between state and federal law, the federal law prevails. The United States Constitution prevails. When there is an issue related to rights that are provided to us in the Montana Constitution and the established precedent interpreting that document are what govern. I look at precedent more than I look at anything else. I look at the facts that have been raised before me, the legal arguments that have been made, and not anything that's outside of the record.
Thank you. And your response, Judge Wilson?
Well, it is true that the Montana Constitution contains a number of rights, but the provisions that set out those rights are interpreted like any other provision of our Constitution. What we're talking about is a principle and a process of interpretation, and it should be consistent in all respects as to any particular aspect of the Montana Constitution, and that's how I would approach every legal issue.
Thank you. Our next question for you, we start with Judge Bidegary. Stare decisis is a Latin phrase that means to stand by things decided. It is the legal doctrine that requires court to follow the rules and the principles of previous cases when deciding cases with similar facts. Now, how do you view the doctrine of stare decisis and its application in judicial decision-making?
I think stare decisis is a pivotal principle in judicial decision-making. only if judges who are making the decisions give proper respect and consideration to the cases that have been decided before, and definitely consider them if they are on point on the issue that's before the judge, can justice really prevail. It's incumbent upon judges to consider seriously the cases that have been decided before. As a practicing attorney, the most frustrating thing was to try to evaluate a case based upon the cases, the case law as it was, the statutes as they were enacted, and then have a judge go rogue and do something entirely different. That experience really has taught me how important it is to those who rely on the legal process to have some sort of stability and some sort of understanding of what the lay of the land will be.
Thank you. You get to hear my Latin again. Stare decisis? Am I saying that right? Decisis? Stare decisis. See, we're all learning. Are we all learning tonight? Yes. Wonderful. It's a Latin phrase that means to stand by things decided. It is the legal doctrine that requires courts to follow the rules and principles of previous cases when deciding cases with similar facts. Now, how do you view the doctrine of stare decisis and its application in judicial decision making?
It's the backbone of decision making for judges. And there may be a fundamental misconception among various members of our public about what judges do. They don't invent their decisions out of whole cloth. They are presented in a case where there is a case on point, when there is a precedent that is binding or similar on very similar facts. It's the obligation of the lawyers to present that case to the court in its briefs or in its argument. And it's considered legal malpractice to fail to bring to a court's attention that there is a binding precedent on point existing within Montana law. So stare decisis and precedent is not just where courts go, it's where they start from, and it's the foundation that they build on. Stare decisis tells us that we need to follow our own precedent. We are not considered to be new and unique members of a court, but every new justice is part of a continuing tradition of decision-making by which previous justices' opinions are binding on the members, the new members of the court, so that it's more like a continuing conversation with the Montana about what is the state of the law than a sort of a fit and start approach where, you know, the opinions and the law changes with the personnel.
Thank you. And your 30-second response, Judge Bidegary.
Stare decisis is important. At times, you, as judges, we end up with maybe attorneys that don't bring all of the cases before us. And so it is incumbent, I think, on judges just to make sure that they search out what the established law is at times when they know that not everything has been presented. But it is definitely the hallmark and the key of proper judicial making, decision making for judges to honor and respect the doctrine of stare decisis and follow precedent.
Thank you. And our next question, we start with you. A hallmark of judicial decision-making is to apply impartiality and fairness in spite of one's personal beliefs. Now, there are some who are concerned about the application of fair and impartial standard in contrast to personal bias in judicial decision-making. Now, how do you ensure the public of impartiality and avoiding what is commonly referred to as in, as from legislating from the bench?
There's one way to assure that, and that is for judges to disregard their own beliefs in making decisions under the law. The law is what the law is. The law is accessible to anyone from a non-lawyer, a lawyer, a judge alike. It can be read and can be applied. So that's the first hallmark of fair and impartial decision making. And the second, and perhaps more important than anything else, is that a judge has to listen to both sides before making a decision. Sometimes in a case, it appears that there's precedent on point, that the outcome is largely certain from the very first time the case is filed. But in fact, the facts may be different from the previous case, or the parties may be raising a different argument that's ever been addressed and decided by the court. So fair and impartial decision making means the judge never issues an opinion as to the outcome until both sides have been heard.
Thank you. Judge Bittigieri, once again, the question is, a hallmark of judicial decision-making is to apply impartiality and fairness in spite of one's personal beliefs. Now, there are some that are concerned about the application of fair and impartial standard in contrast to personal biases in the judicial decision-making. How do you ensure to the public of impartiality and avoiding what is commonly referred to as legislating from the bench?
I set aside my personal opinions, values, and beliefs in every case that I decide. I look at the litigants, even if they're not presently, you know, in the courtroom and I'm just reading briefs or whatever, I can envision these are people to whom this case is of utmost importance. It is my responsibility to see to it that they have a fair shake, that they have a level playing field, and that they have their issue decided based on what should be considered. What I personally think about something is not one of those things that should weigh into the decision-making of these litigants' issue. So for 21 years, I've had the practice of doing that. I am able to just completely separate what I personally think from what is presented to me in the courtroom. It is the only way that people can have any kind of trust and faith in our system. And it is an awesome power that we judges have to be making decisions that affect people's lives every day. And I'm very aware of the decisions I make can have impact that is longstanding, from a child custody case to a sentencing to what, you know, whatever. And so it's really important that what I personally think doesn't filter into the decision.
Thank you. Your final 30-second response, Judge Wilson.
Thank you. I never rule based on the desired outcome for me personally, but I never give up or forfeit my own values for truth and honesty. I think a judge has to apply and adhere to those values in every case and require that attorneys or parties appearing before the court are prepared and candid to the court and honest in all of their responses.
Thank you. Okay, we're moving on to the section of key issues and public concerns. We start with you, Judge Bittigieri. How do you view the role of the judiciary in protecting individual rights and liberties?
The judiciary has a pivotal role in protecting individual rights and liberties. The Montana Constitution, like the United States Constitution, requires the separation of powers so that there is a check and balances and a system to minimize the likelihood of an abuse of power. Our three branches of government are the legislative to pass the laws, the executive to enforce them, and the judicial to interpret and apply them. These three branches have distinct roles, and it's incumbent on the judiciary to stay within its role. And then when there is an implication that one of the other two branches of government has overreached its constitutionally provided power, it's the responsibility of the judiciary to rein that particular branch of government in and assure that those rights that are guaranteed to each Montanan are protected.
Thank you. Judge Wilson, once again, the question is, how do you view the role of the judiciary in protecting individual rights and liberties?
It's well established in Montana law that the Montana Supreme Court is the last full and final arbiter of what individual rights are under our Constitution. The legislature, in coming up with our laws in every session, most often is balancing not only rights but conflicts of interests between various parties and trying to decide what's the best way to resolve these conflicts. But when it comes to individual rights, it goes without saying that the Montana Supreme Court has the final say on what those rights mean, what is their extent, and how they apply.
Thank you. In your final 30-second response, Judge Bittigieri.
It's imperative that because the Montana Supreme Court is the final arbiter of what our rights are, that during times when there are efforts to politicize the court and attack it and undermine the public's confidence in it, the people who serve on the Montana Supreme Court are fair, impartial, and not prone to being swayed by external pressures like public opinion and partisan politics.
Thank you. Next question, Judge Wilson, we start with you. What is your stance on the balance between state and federal authority?
Well, when the federal authority applies in a situation, it has supremacy over state law. The way that the federal constitution essentially works is that it grants only specific powers to the federal government, and the proper interpretation of that grant of powers is that if it's not granted to the federal government by way of the Constitution, then that power does not exist under the Constitution. States, on the other hand, are deemed to be sovereign in every respect except where their policies, where their constitution, where their laws are in conflict with the federal government. So the appropriate balance is that the states must be respected by the federal government to do what states are authorized to do on their constitutions. But if there's a conflict, then federal rule prevails.
Thank you, Judge Wilson. Once again, Judge Bidegary, the question is, what is your stance on the balance between state and federal authority?
There are certain principles that govern that question, and one of them is federal supremacy, that the United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and the United States Supreme Court is the arbiter of what that document means. State autonomy is another concept that we have to take into account, and that is that although the United States Constitution provides citizens basic rights, our state constitution can provide additional rights, which it does. I mean, we have rights provided in the Montana Constitution that are not reflected in the United States Constitution. Among those rights are the right to privacy, the right to equal opportunity for education, the right to public access to land and water, the right to a clean and healthful environment, the right to know, and the right to participate. We have some unique rights clearly spelled out within our Constitution. The Montana Supreme Court is the arbiter of what those rights are and what they mean, and so when there is a conflict between state and federal law, it's true that the United States Constitution and federal law are superior. But when it comes to interpreting our rights under the Montana Constitution, the Montana Supreme Court is responsible for doing that and is the guardian to protect that there is no infringement of those rights that we have all been given.
Thank you. And your final 30-second response, Judge Wilson?
The state and federal constitution, of course, are sometimes in conflict. I think that we cannot ever believe that we'll live in a time where certain people don't believe that there's either federal overreach or that states' rights are being trampled. I think it's important that judges maintain the balance that has come down and that we all understand is binding upon all of us.
Thank you. And our last question for this segment. Judge Bidegary, we start with you. What is your view of the judiciary's role in addressing significant public policy issues like voting rights, access to abortion, and climate change?
Those issues are policy issues left to the other two branches of government. It is not the judiciary's role to address public issues like that. However, if after the legislature has enacted a law or the executive branch has taken some sort of action based upon the law as they understand it, a question is raised about the way the action was taken or about the constitutionality of the law that was enacted, it's the responsibility then of the Montana Supreme Court to consider the arguments made, the issue directly before them, the precedent that's been established, and resolve the issue.
Thank you, Judge Wilson. Once again, the question is, what is your view of the judiciary's role in addressing significant public policy issues like voting rights, access to abortion, and climate change?
Montana has what's called a populist constitution, and it sets out in one of its first provisions that all political power is vested in the people of Montana in their majoritarian sense. So these issues, the leadership on them, come from the people through their elected representative. And it's not appropriate for any justice or any judge to get out ahead of a public debate and say, well, when this issue comes to me, this is what I'm going to rule. If someone ever argues that this right means something or another, I'm going to overrule this one argument. Judges, in order to maintain the appearance of having a fair and impartial judiciary, must not rule or announce or indicate a ruling in advance of that case actually landing at the Supreme Court, only after the party's been able to establish their factual record in the district court, and only after the parties have presented their arguments on appeal. Only then can the court say that it's fully informed enough on this particular case to make an intelligent, well-supported, and lasting precedent that will earn the respect not only of Montanans now, but for future generations.
Thank you. In your final 30-second response, Judge Bidegiri.
The judiciary's role is just to ensure that the governmental action taken or legislation passed does not violate the Montana or United States constitutions, and it is not the role of the judiciary to address public or social issues.
Thank you. We are moving on to our final section of questions. And Judge Wilson, we start with you for our ethics and accountability section. What measures will you take to maintain transparency and accountability in your judicial conduct?
To conduct the affairs as a justice of the Supreme Court the same way that I've conducted my affairs as a district court judge, following and abiding by the ethical constraints that govern all of us, avoiding the appearance of conflict by taking or making my views known in public, which I would disregard or override in any event if they conflicted with a governing law or provision of the Constitution, and also encouraging the Supreme Court to conduct more oral arguments. Most cases decided by our Supreme Court are only submitted for decision, written arguments or legal briefs. By holding an oral argument, the justices assemble in the Supreme Court courtroom and hear the arguments of the parties, but the public has a chance at that time by viewing the question and answer back and forth between the court and the attorneys of just how much work and sometimes conflict that is among the justices in ultimately resolving the case.
Thank you. Judge Bidegiri, once again, the question is, what measures will you take to maintain transparency and accountability in your judicial conduct?
As for transparency, every decision that I have ever written in my 21 years as a district court judge is available to the public. Not easily in Montana, unfortunately, because we have a system finally of getting those decisions online, and the access to the online versions isn't available to everyone. So the situation we have in Montana is that people have to walk into actually the clerk's office to look at decisions that are made. In contrast, the decisions that the Montana Supreme Court makes are all available online, and the oral arguments that they hear are streamed so that the public has access. And I think that provides transparency. As far as accountability for my judicial conduct, I adhere real strictly to the Code of Judicial Conduct and take seriously that I am basically an ambassador for the judicial branch, and that the way I conduct myself reflects on the entire branch. And so I have lived in a place, in a very rural place, where everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows more about you in a rural place than they know in an urban setting. And I think that my 21 years in that kind of a fishbowl has been transparent, and I think because I conduct myself according to ethics rules, I've been elected 4 times.
Thank you. And your final 30-second response.
If I could change one thing at the Montana Supreme Court by waving a wand, it would be to encourage them or require them to issue fewer what are called non-site opinions. The court issues a number of decisions where it resolves a case among the parties, but it instructs the lawyers and courts that they may not rely on the reasoning of those decisions or the rulings in those decisions in arguing future cases. I believe that in order to provide proper accountability for the Supreme Court's decisions, it should issue many fewer non-site opinions and allow people to rely on what they actually say.
Thank you. For our next question, Judge Bettigieri, we start with you. Please briefly discuss the recusal process, and specifically, how do you plan to address potential conflicts of interest?
The recusal process is the process that requires a judge to take himself or herself off a case when there is a conflict. I have routinely in 21 years taken myself off of a case when there is a professional or personal connection to a case or to a litigant or to an attorney involved in the case. And if elected to the Supreme Court, I will continue to do that. In addition to the kinds of cases on which I've had to recuse myself on the Supreme Court, of course I would have to recuse myself on any case that I had decided that is appealed to the Montana Supreme Court. I have the personal experience of my son being the Dawson County attorney. Dawson County is in my judicial district. It's not in my department, but when my colleague was dying and I was covering his caseload for about a year and my son was a deputy county attorney at that time, I disclosed on the record the relationship I had with him, the potential conflict it was, offered to recuse myself, and practically all the time the litigants and attorneys kept me on the case.
Thank you. Again, Judge Wilson, the question is, please briefly discuss the recusal process, and specifically, how do you plan to address potential conflicts of interest?
Well, there are a number of steps that a justice must recuse him or herself from sitting on a particular Supreme Court case, and those were ones described by Judge Bettigieri. Unlike other judges in Montana, the Supreme Court justices are not ones that can be removed on motion or request of a party alleging that the judge is biased or prejudiced to a certain issue or party. And so it remains up to the justice. A justice, I would impose the obligation on myself to not sit on a case where I had made any sort of public statement in the past that would cause anyone in Montana reasonably to question my fairness and impartiality.
Thank you. And your 30-second response, Judge Bettigieri.
It is important that judges and candidates for judicial positions not prejudge issues that are likely to come before them. And for that reason, I refrain from making any statements other than that I will follow precedent and I'll consider the arguments made. But it's true that if we have any personal bias in a case, it's our responsibility and incumbent upon us to take ourselves off the case. And that would be the situation even on the Montana Supreme Court.
Thank you. Our next question for you, Judge Wilson. What is your stance on judicial transparency? What is your stance on judicial transparency, particularly regarding deliberations and decision-making process?
Well, at the Supreme Court, the deliberations largely occur at weekly conferences of the Supreme Court, and there was an effort some decades ago to have those open to the public under Montana's constitutional right to know. The Supreme Court at that time rebuffed that request and determined that its deliberations were not subject to that open meeting law or right to know requirement. And so that is now precedent. That's now the law of Montana. But again, I believe that even though those conferences presently under law are closed to the public can gain a tremendous insight into the inner workings of the court when the court holds its oral arguments on cases. The lawyers have a better chance to understand what they need to do to persuade the court, but more importantly, the public and the press could follow what is the thinking of these justices on these cases and issues as revealed by their questions.
Okay, so once again, the question is, what is your stance on judicial transparency, particularly regarding deliberations and the decision-making process?
All of the briefs that are filed with the Montana Supreme Court are available to the public online. The arguments that are made to the Supreme Court are streamed to the public. And the decision-making process, basically, then what I think is important for the transparency is that when, after considering those arguments, considering what's been filed, the justices reach their decision, that they take care to explain the rationale. We have a jury system in our country where the jurors deliberations are not public. And as Judge Wilson already explained, we have precedent that says that the Montana Supreme Court's deliberations are not precedent. And I think the reasons that those two kinds of deliberations are kept under wraps, I guess, is so that the people participating in them can freely discuss what their views are. There can be free discourse and exchange of ideas, and that you have the best chance of the best conclusion and the best factors considered in the decision-making process. After that process of deliberation, which is not open to the public, is concluded, then it's really important that the author of the opinion clearly set out the rationale, the analysis, so that people having to follow that decision as precedent have guidance.
Thank you. And Judge Wilson, your final 30-second response?
The transparency of the Montana Supreme Court is somewhat lacking, in my view, and it could be improved. I don't know if there is any sentiment there to consider overruling the precedent that exempts the court from the Montana's constitutional right to know, the citizens to know what their governmental bodies are up to and why, and their deliberations and such. But I stand by my earlier explanation and answer that it's only by seeing the court in action, really, that people can understand what it's doing and why.
Thank you. We do have time for a few more questions, so we're going to jump back to the category of qualifications and experience. So we'll start with you, Judge Bidegary, on this one. Can you discuss a challenging case which you engaged and how you approached it?
Every case that we handle really is challenging because of how important it is to the people that are litigants in the case, to the attorneys when there are attorneys involved, representing those litigants, and the issues that are raised. So I can't point to any particular challenging case, but the cases that are difficult really are in the day-to-day workings of a district court judge are parenting plan cases, where you know that the decision that you're going to make about a parenting plan is going to be based on basically a snapshot of this family's life instead of the video that life is, and that whatever decision you make is going to impact the children, the parents, and generations beyond. The other kinds of challenging cases are sentencing offenders and making sure that you get that right.
Thank you. Once again, Judge Wilson, the question is, can you discuss a challenging case in which you engaged and how you approached it?
Sure. I'm not going to describe this case in a way that hopefully would, well, I hope to avoid making a reference that would highlight this family struggle. But it was a criminal case, and it was one where an African-American stepdad was charged with a crime of molesting a stepdaughter. And I knew that this was going to be a case when tried that was going to possibly arouse some animosities and perhaps inappropriate comments. And I can tell you I spent over a week fretting over this at night, imagining every sort of scenario where someone might say something during jury selection that would introduce racism into this trial. And so I was well prepared for that eventuality, but I was absolutely delighted that there wasn't even a whiff of it during jury selection. The case went to trial. There were problems with witness credibility for the state's witnesses. Ultimately, the defendant's stepdad testified and did so credibly enough to convince the jury that he was innocent and should be acquitted. And it was such a challenging case for me because it was absolutely vital important that the public come to see that our system can operate fairly to everyone, and it only works with the good faith and efforts of our public servants, judges included.
Thank you, Judge Wilson. Your final 30-second response, Judge Bidegary.
I do believe that every case is challenging. I consider every case to be important. And it is just the way that I approach every case is the same. With an open mind, listening intently to the arguments that are made when there are arguments, reading every brief that has been filed in that particular case, and considering the relevant facts, the applicable law, and established precedent.
Thank you. We'll move along to our next question, and Judge Wilson, you'll start with this. What role has legal scholarship and continued education played in your career, and how do you stay informed about evolving legal trends?
Well, legal education, as required by the Montana State Bar for lawyers and by the Montana Judges Association for district court judges, is enforced, but judicial and legal learning is continuous. It's something that we do every day. I reacquaint myself with principles of law in every case where a brief is filed, but more importantly, the Montana Supreme Court publishes daily every single one of its orders and all of its decisions, and I keep up on those by reading them. And that is primarily my legal education for keeping up on the law here in Montana. But also, the federal decisions are reported to us once a week in a circular, and I make every effort to ensure that I keep up with on that law as well. And then, of course, when the legislature's in session, the law is sort of a moving target, and we don't know until they finish their work in the spring what the new laws are going to be. But that's a challenge as well that I'm pleased to undertake.
Thank you. Once again, Judge Bidegary, the question is, what role has legal scholarship and continued education played in your career, and how do you stay informed about evolving legal trends?
I have made legal scholarship and continuing education a very important focus of my legal career. Every person, every litigant, whether the person is a human person or a business entity that appears in court, has the right to expect that the person listening to their case has developed a strong knowledge of the law and applies it. And so I don't word for word read all the cases, but I skim them all. I do word for word read all the cases that are cited to me in the briefs that are filed on a particular issue. And I always, even though it's almost 39 years since I got licensed to practice law, every single time a statute is mentioned, I look it up again because of what Judge Wilson mentioned. The legislature changes things, and I can't keep up always during a legislative session on what's happening. So every single time there's a statute, I look it up again. I don't rely on the fact that I've done this job for a long time. I always refer back to what the law is. And then in addition to attending the mandatory continuing legal education, I attend other non-mandatory legal education, and I read judicial and legal journals.
Thank you. Your 30-second rebuttal, Judge? Rebuttal.
I'm glad to rebut.
Thank you.
Occasionally, but not often, occasionally, I encounter an attorney in court who I am convinced had decided that once they passed the bar exam, they didn't have to crack a law book again. And it's always a disappointing and amazing thing to witness, but I never rely on my memory of what the law is. I mean, we all, through our legal training and experience, have understanding of basic bedrock principles, but the application of that principle in particular to the facts in the case is something we can never truly do competently without going back, reading the cases, and reading the law.
Thank you. We do have time for one more question, and we're going to move back to the section of judicial philosophy and decision-making, and then we will have time for our final responses. And I would like to just point out that I just created a word. Rebuttal is now the combination of rebuttal and response.
I think it
works. So we all just had something new and fun there. Okay, so our final question of the night, since Judge Wilson answered our last question first, we'll start with you, Judge Bidegary. And the question is, the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Montana elevate certain individual rights, such as the right to vote, the right of freedom and religion, and the limit of power of government. Now, how do you approach the balance between individual rights and government powers?
When there is a tension between governmental rights and individual rights, it is imperative that the government establish a compelling state interest, a compelling government interest to infringe upon the individual rights that people are entitled to enjoy. And once the government has, if they do establish that there is a compelling reason for the government to infringe, they show that there is substantial and justified use to do that. Even then, the government is under the established law, under our Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, Montana Constitution, they have to address, I guess, the community's interest in the way that is least infringing on individual rights.
Thank you. Judge Wilson, once again, the question is, the Constitution of the United States, as well as the Constitution of the state of Montana, elevate certain individual rights, such as the right to vote and the freedom of speech and religion and the limit of the power of government. How do you approach this balance between individual rights and government powers?
When the government power or intended action conflicts with an individual right that's enumerated in our Constitution, then the government power must yield. That action must yield to the individual right because it is paramount to the individual. The only instance, and it's well established in the law, where this can be overcome is when the state can demonstrate to the satisfaction of a judge or a court that the state has a compelling interest that overcomes the weight of the individual right.
Thank you. And your final 30-second response, Judge Bidegiri?
Basically, it's that, yeah, the government cannot infringe on individual rights without establishing a compelling governmental reason, and that the burden for doing that is high, and once they do it, they have to infringe in the least restrictive way.
Thank you. Now, folks, we've made it to our closing arguments here, and we will start with you, Judge Wilson. Why do you believe that you are the best candidate for the associate position?
My career in law and justice has been a continuing one for more than 30 years, and it was undertaken in a very purposeful way so that I would have, at some point in my career, enough experience in every area of law representing people and individuals and companies and entities of every sort and stripe in every sort of case that I possibly could. You don't really understand the impact of the legal system as a lawyer until you've carried the burdens of a client on your shoulder. And that's what you do in every case. And every client experiences those burdens differently. And so until you have the experience of representing people in such a broad section of disputes, you do not really understand what the legal system looks like to the people that it is intended to govern. That's the sort of experience that I had when I first came to the bench. I make it a sort of tentative step to the bench by serving first as a justice of the peace. It was only a 4-year hitch. I figured if I didn't enjoy it, I'd go back to being a lawyer. But I did love it, and I went on to run for successfully for the district court, now serving my second term. And every day that I'm in court, I am still fascinated by the process. I follow it assiduously. I am obedient to the rule of law and the Constitution. And I am very happy to know that our justice system, by and large, works very well for the citizens of Montana. And it's only through the work of experienced judges or justices like myself, I believe, that will keep Montana's Supreme Court held in the high esteem that it deserves to be held in by Montana citizens, and that we will come to respect it as the beacon of justice that it was always intended to be.
Thank you so much, Judge Dan Wilson. We appreciate it. And your closing remarks, Judge Bidegiri, why do you believe that you are the best candidate for the associate justice position?
I got into this race because we need experienced, fair, and impartial justices on the Montana Supreme Court who are not prone to be swayed by public or political pressure. What I bring to this race is over 21 years as a district court judge and almost 18 years before that as an attorney. My first job was working in state government for about 4 years, and in that job I had the privilege, I guess, of really getting to know a specific area of law very well. My next 14 years were practicing law in eastern Montana, a general practice of law, where at times I felt as if I was a jack of all trades, master of none, because I did represent all different kinds of people, all different kinds of business entities, handled all kinds of civil cases, handled all kinds of criminal cases on both the prosecuting end and on the defense end. And I worked hard to maintain a good knowledge of the law in all of those areas. That has served me really well, and it served me well when I was elected to be a district court judge in 2002, because as general jurisdiction trial judges, we go from one kind of a case to the next kind of a case within minutes during the course of a regular day, and practically nothing comes before me in that role that I haven't already had some experience on. On the Supreme Court, I will have had a wealth of experience. By the time, if I'm elected, I would start, I will have had 39 years of legal experience, and I have a proven record of not being prone to pressure by the public, pressure by external forces, and applying the law to the facts as it has been established.
Thank you so much. Folks, if we could get a big round of applause for our candidates, Judge Dan Wilson and Judge Catherine Bidegary. Thank you so much.
You have just heard a debate between the candidates for the Montana Supreme Court Associate Justice seat, Montana 7th Judicial District Court Judge Catherine Bidegary, and Montana 11th Judicial District Court Judge Dan Wilson. It was recorded on the evening of September 26, 2024, in MSU Bozeman's Gaines Hall Auditorium. And it was the first part of the debate featuring the four candidates running to fill the Associate Justice and Chief Justice seats on the Montana Supreme Court in this November 5, 2024 election. They were debating issues and answering questions posed by moderator Missy O'Malley. It was hosted by the Gallatin Bar Association and the Montana State Pre-Law Club. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire, for broadcast and archiving on listener-supported Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. And you can help us continue to bring you quality programs of, by, and for our community by going to kgvm.org and click on the Gold Support KGVM button at the top of the page. We thank you for listening and for your support.